Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, welcome back to the show. And Jose in Los Angeles, we got into an interesting question and we ran out of time. So you had asked me about the story that's in the news right now about the pregnant woman who got a ticket because she was driving by herself in the HOV lane, the carpool lane on the freeway. And her defense was, well, wait a minute, I'm pregnant. So there's another person, you know, in other words, another passenger inside me. Therefore, you shouldn't give me a ticket because there's actually technically two people in the car. So anything you want to add to that description before I proceed?
That's correct, Patrick. And I do have a thought about it, but I would rather hear your opinion.
Well, I'll offer that again. And for the sake of those tuning in right now who didn't hear the few words that I had to say before the break, I'll kind of recap that and then I'll throw it back to you. So, yeah, it's in the news, and it's an interesting, really, it's a thought experiment, if you ask me, as to what does it mean to be consistent or inconsistent if you believe that this unborn child is a person, and I do. You know me. I believe that life begins at conception, and therefore this is a separate, unique, inviolable human being in the womb for 9 months. So the dilemma, or the apparent dilemma, I don't think it's a real dilemma, but the apparent dilemma is, all right, Mr. Madrid, if you're going to be consistent, and that's a real person in her womb, then you better side with her because she's saying she shouldn't get a ticket because there's technically two people in that car. And the law says that two people or more in a car can drive in that lane. If you have one person, you get a ticket. If you have more than one person, you don't get a ticket. I don't think that it is inconsistent to say no, because you can, and I do, hold that this is an unborn, this unborn person is indeed another person. But for the purposes of the law, it's beside the point, because the purpose, and let's look at this law, having lived much of my life, most of my life anyway, in California, born and raised, the laws are intended to reduce traffic, so reduce the number of cars on the freeway, and to reduce smog, pollution, emissions. And so this is an incentive so that, you know, when you're stuck in traffic and you're inching along 5 miles an hour, and then you see the people in the HOV lane just whizzing by at 50, 60 miles an hour, and you think, man, I would like to be in that lane because I'm going to be here on the freeway forever. It's an incentive for you to ride share. And by doing that, then you now have two people or more who now are not in two or three different cars. They're in one car. So it's achieving the purpose of lowering emissions and reducing congestion. So it's not inconsistent to say, on the one hand, yes, this is an unborn this unborn person is a person, but at the same time, for the purposes of this law, it's irrelevant, because that unborn baby is not going to be driving a car otherwise. That unborn baby is not going to be polluting otherwise. So in a way, it's a moot point. It doesn't enter into, in my view, the way in which the law is written. Now, there's another angle, and I hope I can remember this, because I was thinking about it during the break and it probably went through my mind. But that would be, yeah, I think I've got it. So that would be, let's say, you're going to take a plane trip and you get paid, or I'm sorry, rather, you have to pay for your plane ticket. Well, the airline could say, well, if you're going to be consistent, you're pregnant, that's another person, therefore you have to pay for another ticket. Well, but that person is not going to be in the seat next to me. That person's in me. Yeah, but, you know, technically you're two different people, therefore you should pay two plane fares.
Please don't give the airlines any ideas.
Do you see what I mean? Jose, does this logic, how do you feel about it? Because I think we can have our cake and eat it too in this case, where we can say, yes, this is a human being, but for the purposes of this law or buying a plane ticket or something like that, we don't treat this unborn baby as if it's a passenger. We don't treat this unborn baby as if this is someone who has to be a paying customer to buy a plane ticket. I'm sure if we thought about it long enough, we could come up with other examples. But what do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, I'm of the thought that, I think this is, I'm pro-life. I'm Catholic. And, I think this is great that we're actually accepting that there is a person. Isn't that a big change? I'm so happy right now that even everyone is having to take seriously the question of the personhood of the baby and then seeing how it applies. So first of all, I think it's healthy and great. And in terms of the laws, I think there's many ways out of this in terms of being beneficial. The great example you gave about the airline. Well, maybe the airlines start accepting that there is a person, but they're not going to charge for for babies that are still in the womb. They accept it, right. And then that's the amendment to the law. So I think it's great. We're turning the page, hopefully. I think it's interesting because I think this was brought up. I was trying to hear the interview of the person who was bringing this up, the lady. She struck me a little bit kind of trying to maintain a neutrality to the issue, but I felt it was a little bit more towards the pro-choice, but I don't know that in her heart. But I guess if the pro-choice would bring this argument, then it's like, yeah, bring it on. It's great because actually it's about really thinking about a society where there's a person in the womb and then how do we take it case by case and always accept until the end. So I think it's great. But that's my thought.
No, that's good. And this is one of those interesting thought experiments that we can make use of to widen the conversation and get deeper into the reality of what's here. I'll leave you with this thought, Jose. Thanks for raising the question. Dr. Ben Carson, whom I'm sure you're familiar with, he's quoted as saying, if it's not a human being, then why are you harvesting organs from it? And that goes to the issue of the Center for Medical Progress several years ago, you may remember, the undercover exposure of the Planned Parenthood people dickering over prices for body parts over lunch at a restaurant with wine in their hands and very clearly selling these body parts. And so that kind of gets to the heart of the issue. Well, if this is not a human being, why are you harvesting these body parts? You know, what are they from? Are they from a human being? If they're not from a human being, what are they from? So it just opens up the discussion even further. And I'm glad you called on that, Jose. Thank you. How about David now in Hammond, Indiana? Hello, David.
Hi, Patrick. I was calling because I had a thing that's been on my mind for a long time, and I don't ever know if you could give me any sound advice. Or I don't want to waste your time.
I'll try. No, I'm here for you. This is not a waste of my time. I'll do my best.
Okay, thank you. We don't want to think about this when we're growing up, about having a funeral. And, you know, because we're kids, we want to have fun, and time goes by way too fast. And we go to the beach, and we don't want to think about that kind of thing. And so it sounds morbid, but it's a very practical
kind of thing.
About, I'm sorry. the funeral.
Okay.
I don't have my funeral paid for, and I don't want to be cremated.
Okay.
And I was telling people, my grandparents came from Norway, and I said, you know, over there they take care of you from the cradle to the graves, and they don't cremate you necessarily if you want it, and it'll be in your will, but they'll give you a proper Christian burial in the ground, or maybe even a mausoleum. If you feel you really want that, they'll give you maybe not the most expensive one. Maybe the lower cost one, but they could do that for you. And,
okay.
And I don't know what to do. I'm afraid that I'm going to be cremated. And I don't want to be cremated. But I've seen it done.
Are you in danger of death, David? Are you ill or are you in advanced age? You don't sound like you sound pretty young.
Well, I did have a heart catheter done on me where you're not out. Just to see if I have any blood spots in any arteries that are clogged. They did detect one.
Did they say that you're in danger of dying sometime soon?
No, I didn't really want to ask a lot of questions. I had a bad attitude that day.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to pry into your personal details, so forgive me. I don't mean to be overly personal. Here's what I think. Number one, you have an absolute right to express your wishes for how you want your body to be taken care of after you die. And people should respect that. And within reason, they will respect that. So I, like you, I shudder at the thought of cremation. I find it abhorrent, but I also note that the church permits it for those who wish to do so. Sometimes it's for a cost issue. The main thing is, if you've got, you know, nobody knows how long they're going to live, but if you've got the reasonable expectation that you're going to be here for some years, then maybe one solution to this would be to start saving now and put aside some money each month. And then in 5 years' time, you've got enough saved up that you can have the funeral that you want. Another possibility would be to inquire with the Department of Cemeteries in your diocese and find out if there is any program available for people who are, you know, maybe you're not indigent, but perhaps people who are financially disadvantaged and they're not able to pay for a full-scale funeral. And if you don't have family or friends who are going to be footing that bill for you, is there something that the church can do to help you in that regard? So there are some ways that you can explore that. But I really wouldn't worry about this. If you have a will drawn up that specifically says, I do not want to be cremated, I want to be buried, I want to be buried in this place, and here are the steps that I've taken to try to facilitate that, that's all good, because that way there's a roadmap for people to follow once you pass away. Mm-hmm. You know, I would take some practical steps like that.
Before we go, I thought, I was listening to you one time, not too terribly long ago, where you mentioned something about the Knights of Columbus, that somebody can go there and ask them to possibly, I don't know if that had anything to do with the funeral though, for sure, but.
Well, usually the Knights of Columbus would be available for like an honor guard at some funerals. I don't know specifically like what they say yes to. The local council of your Knights of Columbus can tell you that answer pretty quickly. But if it's a cost issue, I'll just reiterate. I think number one, plan ahead, maybe start saving, have a little savings account and you put money in there. And then when you've reached the amount that you're going to need, then maybe you buy the plot or you buy the casket. You can go to Trappist Caskets. They have, these are Trappist monks in Kentucky, I believe, who specialize in making beautiful, simple, dignified wooden caskets at a much less expensive amount of money than you would spend on the deluxe Cadillac version with all the padding that you don't need anyway, obviously. So that would be something to look into. And maybe by the time you've got enough money saved and you've got most of these things paid for, then you can breathe easy. I hope that that happens sooner rather than later, David. Thank you. Let's go to Mary now in Colorado Springs. Hello, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well,
thanks. I have a complicated story. We had a family reunion, and one of our family members has been struggling with bone cancer for several years. It is on really the a trial thing now. So they pretty much exceeded what they could do. Anyway, my daughter, who lives here and is a mature woman, not a child, and is a wishy-washy Catholic, I'll just put it that way, knew this woman who calls herself a healer, a Catholic woman, and goes to our church. And she asked her to come over for a healing service for our ailing relative. I wasn't there because I didn't know about it, but I heard this story both from my daughter and several other family members who were there. So the woman comes in and gives her life story for a long time. And anyway, she prays over the family member, but spends most of her time talking directly to my daughter. I see colors. She said, you're shining, you're glowing, you have this sparkly stuff all over your hand. She mentioned stuff like there's been, generally speaking to the people that were there, there's been an unexpected death in the family. I see the numbers, 9, 15, 17. yeah. and, you know, what with an age. And then
can you sense my frustration level rising, Mary? And not with you, but with this woman who's saying these things.
I know. Yeah. Yes, I'm very disturbed.
Well, this sounds like a woman who, even though she doesn't use the title medium, or I'm guessing she doesn't, that's what she thinks she is.
No, she doesn't.
Okay, but that's what this sounds like.
That's what I think she is. Yeah.
So.
Well, right.
So I'll offer you a few thoughts. Number one, the Catholic Church says, this is paragraph 2116 of the Catechism, if you want to jot it down and go back and share it with your daughter. All forms of divination are to be rejected. Recourse to Satan or demons conjuring up the dead or other practices falsely supposed to unveil the future, consulting horoscopes, astrology, palm reading, interpretation of omens and lots, the phenomena of clairvoyance, which is exactly what she's purporting to do, and recourse to mediums all conceal a desire for power over time, history, and in the last analysis, other human beings, as well as a wish to conciliate hidden powers. They contradict the honor and respect and loving fear that we owe to God alone. So even though she may say she's Catholic, I remember there was a TV show for a while called The Long Island Medium, or I think it was The Long Island Medium. And it was this, you know, purportedly Catholic woman who wrapped herself in the mantle of her Catholic faith. But all she was doing is just this medium shtick. And so all of the stuff about seeing auras and sparkly things and all that, this is just coming out of her own mind and imagination, or she is in some way being influenced by demonic spirits. So I think your concern is well placed, and hopefully your daughter will turn away from this, because this is, you know, right there in the occult, even though it's dressed up with some Catholic piety.
Yeah, because she calls on the name of Jesus and all that kind of stuff. So but my red flags went up immediately. And the question, and really, it's a two-pronged thing, because, one, I have to somehow gently talk to my daughter about this without confronting her and driving her to this woman. She gave the woman money, and I think the woman is actually trying to, I could say, recruit her to be an advocate under her, because my daughter's a highly successful salesperson. Anyway, the other thing is, ought I go to our parish priest?
And do what?
I don't know. Just say this person is doing this stuff within the boundaries of our church, and she's had... Should I not? Should I just leave it alone?
Well, okay, so is she doing this under the auspices of the parish, or is she just happened to be on parish grounds when she's doing this?
She's neither, actually. She went to a private home, so she's not.
Okay. Well, I mean, okay. Is she a parishioner? Is she?
Yes, she is.
Okay.
Yeah, she is a parishioner.
I can see a scenario in which you would want to alert the pastor that this is going on. Father, do you realize that a member of your parish has set up shop and calling herself a healer and taking money for people to come and have her tell them things about their life or whatever? You know, I'm hoping that he's a really good and conscientious priest. And if he is, he's going to want to know about that. And how he handles it, of course, I don't know. But I could imagine a scenario where he would say to her privately, you know, stop this. This is not good for you. This is not in keeping with the church's teaching.
That's kind of where I was coming from, because I don't want this happening. And she's got a website where she, asks for money if you'd like donations.
See, that's the problem right there. Is that this is not the same thing as some woman who, or man for that matter, who honestly believes that she has the gift of healing. There are people, I've met them, and they are sincere in their belief that God has given them the gift of healing. Now, from what I can see, I don't believe that God indeed has given them this gift of healing. But in their own minds, they believe that it's true. That's different from somebody like this woman who has set up shop. She's a fortune teller. She's a medium. She's a clairvoyant, or she purports to be. And so this is her way of making money by duping credulous people. I'm sorry to say it, Mary, but like your daughter. If your daughter is highly intelligent and she's very successful, she's making a lot of money, well, this woman knows a mark when she sees it. And if she's able to lure your daughter in because she's giving her something that she wants. Oh, look how sparkly you are today. I can see your aura. I've had people tell me this, Mary. I've shown up at speaking events for, well, 35 plus years now that I've been doing public speaking. I've shown up at speaking events, and it's always women. It's never a man for some strange reason. And I've had it when the woman comes over and says, oh, I can see your aura, and let me tell you what the Holy Spirit is telling me about you. And I just turn around and walk away, you know, because it's,
yep,
it's not real. Mm-hmm. It's in their imagination. Or even worse, it's a diabolical influence. Either way, I want no part of it. And whatever reason these people feel deluded that they have these gifts and things, that's between them and God. But I'm with you, Mary. I think you're right to be concerned. I think you're right to do what you can to dissuade your daughter from doing this. Let her see what the Catechism says. I quoted that paragraph for you, paragraph 2116. I would share those details with her. Also, as long as I'm at it, I happen to have a book. It didn't even occur to me till just now. Get a copy of this book. It's called The Devil's Role in the Spiritual Life, and it's by Father Cliff Ermatinger, E-R-M-A-T-I-N-G-E-R, Cliff Ermatinger. The Devil's Role in the Spiritual Life, St. John of the Cross is teaching on Satan's involvement in every stage of spiritual growth. And so it's very insightful. He quotes St. Thomas Aquinas, he quotes St. Augustine, but he certainly quotes St. John of the Cross. And he analyzes the phenomenon of diabolical influence in subtle and hidden ways. And it sounds to me like what your daughter is dealing with would fit into that category. So maybe if you got a copy of this book and gave it to her and said, well, you know, there's another side to this story and you should check it out. I have to take a break though, Mary. Thank you. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres,
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday.
Coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day. That's the reason why I'm more away. Better, I don't care, homie, let them hate. I'm just trying to eat another plate. Another one. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro tacos.
All right. Yeah. It's good, though. Don't get me wrong, Cyrus. I do like that song. I'm easily pleased, easily amused.
Yeah, so you still like it? Keep it in the rotation?
I love it.
It's so good.
How can you not like that?
We still get emails. Where is that song? Where can I find it?
We do it in Mexico all the time. Hit me with that.
We do it in Mexico all the time. I think they have the heater on or something. You don't feel like your head is burning or anything?
No.
Go home and lay down.
Yeah, that's how people feel after this show's over. Dear Patrick, Michael says, I am Catholic and at least until the start of the pandemic went to church every week. Yet I have wondered about the idea of making weekly church attendance obligatory as the church does. The obligatory aspect of it seems oxymoronic. Why should anyone be obligated to partake of the most precious gift ever given to mankind, the Eucharist? If anything, you might think that the churches would need to provide security, as is done at music concerts, to keep Catholics from stampeding into or overfilling any building where the Mass is celebrated. We don't make it obligatory for music lovers to listen to music. In other words, for them to do something that they're going to do anyway, and that indeed no one could prevent them from doing. Why should it be obligatory to attend Mass? This is a really good question, Michael. So I would approach it this way. Number one, it's obligatory, or I think it should be obligatory in the same way that you and your wife would tell your kids, we're having dinner at 6 o'clock and all you guys have to be sitting at the dinner table. We're having dinner together as a family. Now the kids, yeah, they want to eat, but they would prefer to eat in front of the TV or up in their room or something like that. But you have a reason for saying eating is good, and I know you want to eat, but we want you to eat in this context, around the family table, where we can all be together as a family, we can talk, we can share our day, interact, because it's important. And if you don't do that, obviously the family ties begin to loosen over time. So this is part of the church's way of saying we are a big family and we're going to eat our meal together and celebrate what Jesus did for us and worship Jesus in spirit and in truth, etc. So that's one reason, it seems to me. The other one, and I do get what you're saying, obviously, you know, if the Beatles showed up, you wouldn't make it obligatory that everybody's got to go do that because you'd have tons of people who would be stampeding to get there. I understand that. But that, unfortunately, is not how the average Catholic is when it comes to Mass, because we're lazy. And a lot of people don't necessarily see the Mass as something enjoyable. They don't see it as entertaining. Some Catholics see it as, this is a duty. I've got to do this. Oh, boy, I got to go to Mass. I've always liked it when people say, I get to go to Mass, which is the point that you're making. So human nature being what it is, and the church being a wise mother, recognizing that her children would probably rather not have to gather around the dinner table and have supper together as a family, makes it a requirement. And it's just the most minimal of requirements. Kind of like your kids are off busy doing other things, but at the very least, guys, the very least, we're all going to be together for half an hour or however long dinner takes. We're at the very least going to do that. So it kind of sets the bar rather low, but it's still important. Those are my thoughts. Very good question, by the way. Second email came in. This is from Greg in Minneapolis. Daily listener, he says, but something from an earlier show concerning immigration caught my ear. The gentleman who called in toward the beginning of that hour gave the impression that America's borders were wide open to anyone who wanted to come in. Although this was largely the case for the early history of this country, in the late 1800s, anti-immigration policies picked up. See generally the Chinese Exclusion Act and the Immigration Law of 1917, the Emergency Quota Act of 1921, the Immigration Act of 1924. Aside from the Chinese Exclusion Act, a number of these laws were targeted at Southern and Eastern Europe, then considered by the WASPs here to be undesirable nations filled with communists and reprobates. And they instituted these quotas based on the percentage of each nationality in the United States based on prior censuses. Even today we have a quota system, though it's more generous than in the past. You, referring to me, had mentioned that countries have the right to protect their borders, and indeed they do. My point is simply that the United States supposedly being more stingy in allowing immigrants to enter the country is a new phenomenon, as is not true. You gave fair light to the subject, but I wanted to add a very cursory bit of historical background as well. Love the show. Thank you, and God bless you. Well, thank you, Greg in Minneapolis. Appreciate all of that. I concur with you. The one thing I can add to that is simply that depending upon which political party is in power, you will see the border to the south either more or less effectively guarded. And right now we're in a time when vast numbers of people, maybe record-settingly vast numbers of people, are just simply walking in because they can, because the current regime, as has been the case with earlier regimes, the democratic regimes in any case, they want that. They desire to make it as accessible as possible for people to come in, never mind what our laws are. I mean, just look at the ridiculousness of the so-called sanctuary cities throughout California. Is another kind of a microcosm of the same mindset. And that is, they want these people to come in because they know that they're going to vote as Democrats. If these people coming in, some of whom are from my own, you know, family culture and country of Mexico, which I'm 100% Mexican on my father's side, you know, some Spanish mixed in there going way back, but my father and his family all Mexican. From Mexico, in the case of his parents. So the point is, I have, you know, family roots in this area, and not that that matters one way or the other, but I can just simply point out the fact that if all these folk who are coming up from El Salvador and from other parts of Central America, certainly Mexico, if they were coming in mass numbers and voting Republican and voting pro-life, you know, and I know, and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi know, that they would be standing on the border with guns trying to keep those people out. They would. But the reason that they're flinging the doors wide open as best they can is because they know that if we get all those folk to come into this country, sooner or later, they'll be assimilated into situations where legally or illegally, they're going to vote. And they're going to vote for the Democratic Party. And it's just a self-evident fact, if you ask me, it's of long standing. So I'll add that to the mix. I'm sure I irritated somebody by saying that, but that's what I believe. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Debbie in Minneapolis. Good morning, Debbie.
Hi, Patrick. I'm calling in regarding the woman with celiac disease that hasn't been able to receive communion.
Yes.
I have celiac, and I receive in a separate chalice at Mass, and I've been able to do that through COVID. So I just wanted to suggest that if she wants to bring that up to her priest. My parish is very accommodating in having that for me. I don't have to worry about cross-contamination with people who are receiving the hosts and then drinking from the chalice. So that's how I receive precious blood.
Yes, and I've seen that happen at parishes all around the country. So if the pastor is accommodating, that would be a good suggestion, Debbie.
Yeah, I just sit in a certain section of the church and go to a certain line for communion, and I'm able to receive.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad to hear that they have that available for you. Now, I don't know how old you are. I don't need to know how old you are, Debbie, but just for me, I was born in 1960, and as I think back on growing up, I don't remember ever even hearing about people with a gluten intolerance or celiac disease. It never crossed my radar screen, let's say, certainly not as a child in the 60s, but even as a teenager and a college student in the 70s, I don't remember that this was ever even a thing. So I wonder, and I don't know, but maybe you can shed some light on it, is celiac disease, is this a phenomenon that has exploded in recent decades where it's becoming much more prevalent? Or was it always there and people just didn't know what to call it? And it was a problem that people dealt with, because it seems like now it's so much more prevalent than I ever remember it. Do you know what I'm saying?
I had it as a young child. I'm 63 now. Excuse me, I have a cold. But I wasn't diagnosed till I was 40. But I was sickly and underweight and for all the years of my life until it was discovered. And even then, it was kind of unusual to have celiac.
Yeah.
But since I changed my diet, it's like night and day. My health is so much better.
That's good.
And I'm able to...
So when you were a kid and you'd go to Holy Communion, let's say 8, 9, 10 years old, would you feel sick to your stomach afterward?
I just remember that I was always sick to my stomach. So I don't remember that it was specific to communion.
Mm-hmm.
But it was rare when I was diagnosed. I know now it's become more common, and I think it's just become more well-known. There's a lot of gluten intolerance, but celiac is specifically an autoimmune disease, and it's also hereditary. So it's just something I think that was underdiagnosed and has become more well-known. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, fair enough. It's not my world. For whatever reason, God didn't give me that cross to carry. But I have a lot of empathy for you and people who are in your situation, Debbie. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Let's go to Cecilia now in Queens. Good morning, Cecilia.
Hi. Good morning, Patrick. This is Cecilia. I have a question regarding John 4, verse 9. The story about the Samaritan woman, how did she know that Jesus was a Jew? Do they have a particular appearance? When she said, how can you, a Jew, ask me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink?
Yes. Well, there would have been a few markers. Number one, the Samaritans kept to themselves. They were not accepted by the Jews. So they were considered, they called them things like half-breeds, and they looked down on them. They scorned them. So Jesus knew where the Samaritan folk lived, and so traveling through that area, he would know that these are Samaritans, and then she would have known that he wasn't from there. That'd be one way, because he would not have been familiar to her. Another way would be by the way they spoke. So even though Aramaic was the common language among the Jews, it wasn't necessarily the common language among the Samaritans, because the Jews had been taken away in captivity. It doesn't mean that some of the Samaritans may not have also, but the Jews were taken to Babylon, modern-day Iraq. And so they spoke a dialect that was the result of being in captivity for those hundreds of years, and that's Aramaic. So even just Jesus speaking, she would have known he's not one of us. He's a Jew. And the same would be true for Jews. They would know that the Samaritans. Now, there may have been other things. There may have been a manner of dress that would have been different. I'm sure there were subtle cues, but they were sufficient that one group would recognize the other group.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Now, I would recommend, if you're at all interested in going deeper, there's a great book by Henri Daniel Rowe. Its last name is hyphenated, Daniel hyphen Rowe, R-O-P-S. It's called Daily Life in the Time of Jesus. And it's a beautiful historical survey of the Bible lands and the food and the customs and the language and the clothing and all the things that would have been present at the time of Jesus in the Holy Land. This book by this French historian is really helpful. So I remember the first time I read it, it really opened my mind up to a lot of these details. And I have a feeling if you read this book, you'll be very edified by it. Okay, I'm looking at the clock and I see it's time to take a break. So we'll do that. We have one more segment to go. If you want to jump in with your phone call, call me at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity Healthshare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. We don't have much time left, but if you want to jump in with your comment or question, my number is 888-914-9149. We'll get you on the air as best we can. Let's see. Let's go to Elias in Lexington, Kentucky. Good morning, Elias.
Good morning, Patrick. Peace upon you.
Thank you.
I was listening to a rabbi last week on the radio, and of course, I'm paraphrasing here. She said, "If when the baby in the womb not being considered a human, and that's why the Jewish women can abort the baby. And if the baby was born not being considered also a spiritual human, I'm paraphrasing,
okay,
till after 7 weeks. Could you explain that to me, please?"
Well, I'm not a doctor of the law. I mean, I'm not saying that to be flippant or anything, but I'm not an expert on rabbinic commentaries or opinions on things. So I would say if that's what some rabbis say, okay, that's what some rabbis say. I don't adhere to rabbinic teaching because they don't have any authority, in my view at least. So I would just say it is what it is. And I go by what the Catholic Church teaches, and that is that life begins at conception, and therefore this unborn person is an unborn person. Therefore, to end that person's life through abortion would be killing an innocent human being, and I don't believe we have the right to do that. So if there are Jewish folk who don't agree with me and they cite rabbinic commentaries, I can say, well, okay, I think you're wrong, but I don't share that view. In other words, since I'm not sure if that fully has the impact that I want, in other words, even if Jewish rabbis, in commenting on Jewish scriptures and interpreting them, say, well, this is why we think it's okay to abort a baby, that does not cut any ice with me. That does not sway me. That does not impress me. I will grant that they have a lot of expertise in knowing those scriptures, but at any given time, if they arrive at an erroneous conclusion, they've arrived at an erroneous conclusion. And to use a parallel example, Elias, you and I, because I know that you're a Christian, you and I would look at many passages in the Old Testament and we would see the glimmer of or an implicit reference to Jesus or to the triune God. Jews reject those interpretations. So the fact that a Jewish rabbi might interpret the suffering servant passage in Isaiah as being something other than Jesus does not impress me. The fact is, that's a prophetic reference to Jesus. Now, he may read it and say, well, these are our scriptures, and we know them inside and out and frontward and backward, and we read them in Hebrew, and we don't think that that means Jesus. I would say, okay, whatever, you're wrong. And I would take the same approach in this regard, not to be disrespectful, but just to say that they've reached an erroneous conclusion when it comes to unborn life. Does that make it a little clearer?
Yes. Thank you, Patrick, very much.
Okay. Always nice chatting with you, Elias. Thank you for that. Let's go to Jose now in Indio, California. Good morning, Jose. I imagine it's quite warm in Indio today, isn't it?
Yeah. It's getting up to close to 117. But anyhow, good morning.
Man. Listen, man, oh, man, oh, man. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Listen, I have a question. I was listening to your show yesterday about the question that the lady made about how many people could be mentioned at the time of the Mass or the intention of the Mass for how many people would be dedicated, whatever.
Right, right.
Anyhow, recently I was talking to a friend of mine who happens to be a priest, and he was saying that at the end of the Mass, when he gives the final blessing to everyone, that reaches every person that who's there, right? And then he says, but sometimes after Mass, some people come to me and ask me for another blessing. And he says, so the blessing that I gave, it was to everyone, and the other blessing that they're asking for, there's nothing different between the two. Having said that, if we have a Mass and we have a loved one that passed away, and we want to dedicate the Mass to that person, isn't it the same? Like, if God knows that in our intentions, in our minds, and our hearts, if we're dedicating that Mass to that loved one, does it make a difference whether if the priest mentions those names or not? I mean, when if he offers the Mass for all the ones that have departed, does it make a difference?
Yes, it does. And I understand your question. The thing to remember is we're not talking about, or at least the call that came in, as I recall, was not talking about just the priest in his desire to invoke God's blessings on people just to include many different people, but it had more specifically to do if somebody asked for a Mass to be celebrated for the specific intention, and all the more so when it's accompanied by a Mass stipend, which is a thank you gift to the priest. He's taking time out of his day. He's going to celebrate a separate Mass, a special Mass, or if it's the one Mass that he might celebrate that day, he's going to celebrate it for this specific intention. And so in that context, it is important, number one, that when the priest receives this donation, which we call a stipend, that he follow through and actually celebrate the Mass for that person, for that intention. And that so it's a matter of justice there. But also because this is not intended to be just sort of like generally for everybody. The Mass is for everybody, and it does benefit the body of Christ every time any Mass is celebrated. But it has a particular spiritual effect for the person for whom it is celebrated, if it's a family or somebody who has died, for example. So yes, the church does want the priest to, if he's accepting that stipend, to follow through and to celebrate the Mass for that particular intention. Is that clarified for you?
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure because I was having a hard time to understand that. Because I said if the priest mentions that the Mass is offered for all the ones that have been departed, I go like, well, why mentioning names then if it's for all of those that have departed already?
Right. Well, okay, this is probably going to be an absurd comparison. I hope it isn't. But I'm an author. So if you came to me and said, hey, would you sign a book for my dad? It's his birthday tomorrow. You would expect me to sign the book for your dad with his name. You know, dear Jose Sr., happy birthday, sincerely Patrick Madrid. If I just wrote in the book, hey, everybody who's having a birthday today, happy birthday, and you gave that to your dad, it's obviously not what you intended, and it wouldn't be specific to your dad. So I know that's a super mundane way of trying to make a comparison, but I think maybe that will help us see what we're driving at here. Anyway, I have to leave it at that, but thanks, Jose. I appreciate it. Let's go to Carolyn now in Albuquerque. Hi, Carolyn.
Good morning, Patrick. I had a question. My son turns 11 next month, and I'm trying to find a good Christian or Catholic-based book that talks about the birds and the bees, because I don't want him getting it at school. So
yeah. Well, I... Yeah, I think the best place to go to find out an answer to that would be Holy Heroes. Their website is holyheroes.com. I don't receive any financial benefit in any way from recommending them to you, but I know the people involved, and they have a lot of good resources. I think it was the other day, or maybe it was last week, I talked about one of their books called Good Pictures, Bad Pictures, and that's how you can help little kids who don't know about the birds and the bees, or at least they don't know all of it, they can still be, they can learn how to be shielded from pornography, even at a young age, before it's age appropriate for them to know about any of these things. So that's one of the resources I know that they do have, Good Pictures, Bad Pictures. And then I do believe they have other resources that might help in this specific regard, but that's where I'd go to check it out.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
Okay. You're most welcome. Nice to chat with you. Thank you. Yeah, we can't take enough care and enough caution in protecting our children's innocence, don't you think? We'll go now to Donna in Phoenix. Hello, Donna.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, last week I heard several people say, or recently, that you could receive Holy Communion twice a day. And it seems to me like that goes directly against the Our Father, where it says our daily bread. Otherwise, he's just a little cookie that you hand out whenever you feel like it. I don't know. I think it's totally wrong. And just another symptom of Vatican II. I'm sorry. Hmm. But anyway.
Well, that's okay. Well, let me ask you this question. When you pray for, like you and I both pray, give us this day our daily bread, that means, of course, Holy Communion, but it also more broadly means food in general, right?
Yeah, but that's, he's not food in general.
No, I know that, but what I'm saying is that the prayer itself is not restricted just to Holy Communion. It's for all of our necessities. Okay, so it would include food, right?
It would.
Okay, so do you eat only one meal a day?
Okay, fine. You know, when did this start? I understand where you're going to go with it, that you can, well, then we can just have snacks all day long, right?
Well, yeah, we could. If we're talking about food, and I'm not talking about the whole Eucharist here, I'm just saying if we were looking at the Our Father, give us this day our daily bread, and that includes food as such, just regular food, it doesn't mean that we only have one meal. It doesn't restrict us to one meal. I'm not here to say that people should go to Holy Communion more than once a day unless there's some reason to do so. All I'm saying and what I said earlier is that the church permits it under some circumstances.
When did they start permitting it? Because I don't think it was ever permitted.
Well, that's a good question, Donna. I would have to consult the canon law history on that issue. I don't really know. I don't know whether it was something that arose from Vatican II on. I suspect if you're prejudiced against Vatican II, then if it did, that would make you feel better, I guess. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was permitted under certain circumstances before Vatican II. I would just have to check.
Okay. I sure would appreciate it if you would, because I really don't believe it, because every single solitary part of our faith was changed. Every part of it, Patrick.
No, it wasn't.
I mean, the Our Father itself was changed. Yeah, it was.
No, it wasn't. We believed in Jesus before Vatican II. Do you believe in Jesus after Vatican II?
You're right. That's the one thing that didn't change. But every Protestant in the world believes in Jesus. But we have the special gift of the Blessed Sacrament. You shouldn't be treated like a snack.
Well, see, Donna, I think that you are interpreting this permission that the church gives to receive Holy Communion under some circumstances more than once. I think you're in a tendentious way interpreting it in the worst possible light. And I'll draw your attention, Donna, to Pope St. Pius X, who at the beginning of the 20th century, he revised, against some of the opinions of people, he revised the church's custom of, he said that children should receive Holy Communion early, like at the age of reason, 7. And that wasn't the custom prior to that point. And he also said that people should receive Holy Communion daily. And some people reacted negatively against that because they thought, well, that's, then you're really sort of debasing the value of the Holy Eucharist because you're making it so commonplace. If everyone can have it every day, then it's no longer really special. And that's kind of an extension of your argument. But Pope St. Pius X said, no, Jesus desires that we receive him in the Holy Eucharist as often as possible. And so he lowered the age and he made daily communion the norm. You see?
Okay. Well, then if you're using that logic, then at some point, and it keeps going farther and farther, I mean, we've got politicians that are openly with going, receiving Holy Communion, supporting abortion, and then being received by the Holy Father like they're just wonderful people.
Yeah, see, Donna, though, you're veering off into a non sequitur. That has nothing to do with the point you originally raised. You originally said that it was offensive. That's not the word you used, but offensive that the church might permit receiving Holy Communion more than once per day because it cheapened or debased the sacrament into something like a snack or a cookie. All I'm saying is that is the wrong way to look at this. The church desires that we receive Holy Communion as often as possible, not multiple times a day, but certainly daily, as a way to receive this great gift of Jesus in the Holy Eucharist. Now, within reason, obviously, we don't have the Holy Eucharist 3 times a day, 5 times a day, or anything like that. But if you're allowed to have it more than once per day under certain circumstances, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Anyway, please think about that, Donna, and call me again. I'd love to talk to you again. Until next time, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.